Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
4 years ago, Russia invaded Ukraine. 4 years. That means 4 years of war. 4 years in which thousands of people have died. 4 years in which cities have been bombed to rubble. The Russians are terrorizing cities like Kherson, Kyiv, Odessa, and Dnipro with constant drone and bomb attacks. A city like Kyiv, a metropolis of over 1 million, is largely without electricity. The same goes for Odessa, and yet somehow people are trying to endure. I am currently traveling in Ukraine again, recording this episode of our In Crisis Mode podcast here in Slovyansk, a city in Donbas. Last night we spent in an apartment here and could hear attacks, hear explosions, because these cities are under fire. At the heart of this episode is the question, how do people preserve their resilience, their hope, and their determination to survive this war? How do they endure daily attacks, life without electricity, heating, gas, or running water? For example, in Odessa, I met Svetlana, an elderly woman who described to me what life in winter without light is like. She told me she never thought she would have to sit in an emergency tent just to survive. Yet she and thousands of others are holding on, even though Ukraine itself and the souls of its people are now deeply wounded.
So sometimes it feels like we have sunk so deeply into the normality of the abnormal that I don't know how we will ever return to our old life. But I very, very much want to find out.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I'm Jan Jessen, political editor and war and crisis reporter for the Funke Mediengruppe. Odessa is actually a wonderful city, a truly beautiful city, probably my favorite city in Ukraine. A port city on the Black Sea, it has this Mediterranean flair, especially in summer. The light in the city and the city center is particularly beautiful. But Odessa today is a city where many people are suffering because it has been repeatedly attacked in recent days and weeks. The Russian attacks have targeted the city's energy infrastructure. In February alone, there were 8 waves of attacks, causing severe damage. This is extremely difficult for the people. It's currently winter in Ukraine. Temperatures at night drop well below freezing. Without water, electricity, or heating, thousands of people are struggling. In Odessa, I met Svetlana. We were sitting in a so-called resilience tent. These tents are now in cities all over Ukraine. They call them points of invincibility. In these tents, people without electricity or heating can warm up. They can get a hot soup, charge their power banks and mobile phones. They are also places where people meet, chat, and feel connected. Svetlana was one of those women sitting in the tent, an elderly lady, gray-haired, 75 years old. She told me how much she loves the beauty of her city, even though the war is demanding so much from her and her neighbors.
Знаходимося ми в місті Одеса, в палатці для обігріву, тому що в нас нема світла.
We are in the city of Odessa in an emergency tent because we have no electricity. And what do I wish for? I wish that this all ends soon, that we have peace, that there are smiles and joy. Odessa is the most beautiful city on earth. There are very nice people here, good humor, very beautiful girls. That is why I wish for peace. And more peace, that this all ends and that people are happy and cheerful, just as before all this began. That is what I wish for.
Дуже радісні, так як було раніше до цього. Оце мені хочеться.
As I said, Odessa is attacked almost daily. Just in February alone, there were 8 waves of attacks on the city. That's when these so-called Shahed drones come into play. They are large drones capable of carrying up to 90 kilograms of explosives flying into Ukraine every night. This winter, they are being deliberately targeted at civilian infrastructure, critical facilities like power substations, heating plants, and similar installations. At the same time, Ukraine faces attacks with cruise missiles, ballistic rockets, and other projectiles. And of course, people in Odessa are tired. They're exhausted from the constant blackouts and the cold. Yet somehow, they manage to keep going. Honestly, that's what has always struck me as remarkable in Ukraine over the years. Previous winters were already harsh, and yet people endure, helping one another, showing solidarity, and fighting every day not to lose their joy for life. This is especially true in Odessa. The people there are proverbially known for their cheerfulness and liveliness, and they somehow try to maintain it even in these hard times. And, as I've said, that strikes me every time I'm in Odessa or in other Ukrainian cities. Of course, I can't help but think about the huge fuss it caused back home in Berlin when the power went out for just a few days. For people in Ukraine, in cities like Odessa, Kharkiv, and Kyiv, this is everyday life. Svetlana's account also shows how drastically life has changed in wartime and how strong the longing for normalcy, for joy, and for peace really is. From Odessa, we continued on to Kherson. Kherson is a city we've reported on multiple times in this podcast. It was the only regional capital in Ukraine that the Russians managed to capture after the invasion began in February 2022. The city was under occupation for months. During that time, war crimes were committed. Cases of torture, abduction, and rape were documented. Kherson was liberated in November 2022, but since then it has essentially been under constant fire because, unlike other Ukrainian cities, Russian forces are right across the river. Kherson lies on the Dnipro, Ukraine's largest river. On the opposite bank, Russian troops repeatedly fire into the city. Now they are also using FPV drones, small drones guided into the city, sometimes deliberately to hunt civilians. Before we entered the city, we were told to cover the press badges on our protective vests, which we always wear in such areas, with black tape so that drone pilots wouldn't identify us as journalists. These drone pilots sometimes deliberately target journalists, treating them as a kind of trophy. So we covered our badges. And at that moment I thought, wow, we really live in extraordinary times. In these times, a press badge, normally meant to protect you, actually becomes a crosshair. You place it on your vest or on the car, and it can mark you as a target rather than keep you safe. Entering Kherson, you see what you also see in other cities, like Slovyansk, where I am now, in the Donbas region. You see kilometers-long tunnels of nets, streets lined on both sides, and even overhead with nets, so that drones, especially small FPV drones, get caught in the nets and possibly explode there, rather than hitting cars or people below. Of course, if an explosion happens 5 meters above you, you're still affected, but the chances of survival are far higher than without these nets. For me, these nets have become a kind of symbol of this winter of war. They began appearing at the end of last year, built along streets and across cities. Now you see them in places like Kherson, Slovyansk, and Kramatorsk, sometimes stretching for dozens of kilometers along the roads. Alexander Prokudin now speaks of 2,500 drone attacks per week, highlighting the cynicism of the Russians, who sometimes even call it a human safari, hunting people on open streets, sharing the crimes online for amusement, making jokes, dropping grenades on children or elderly cyclists. This brutal dehumanization in the war is truly shocking. Alexander Prokudin is the governor of the Kherson region. I met him in a bunker. Naturally, I can't disclose the exact location. Deep underground, he works with his staff. He shared background information, figures, and facts about what's happening in Kherson and explained how the city is trying to keep fighting, continue providing security for its residents, and remain resilient. I also asked him about the mood in the city and the wider region, how people are feeling right now.
Тяжке питання. От тут три роки саме на цій позиції, на цьому посаді.
That's a difficult question. I've been in this exact position for 3 years now, and even longer in office overall. And I see how the mood of the people is changing. I see that in Kherson and in other parts of the region, there are more and more red zones. Places that I used to be able to travel to and visit are now completely abandoned. No one lives there at the moment. Of course, we are very tired of the war, not just us in the administration, but all people, including the soldiers. Naturally, you wish that this war would finally end. But at the same time, it is clear. We will remain on our land until this conflict is over. This is our land. These are our people. And we will not simply give it up the way Russia would like us to.
This time I visited Kherson because I wanted to follow the trail of the war crimes that have been committed there, and for me it was particularly important to ask the question, how exactly are these war crimes being investigated in Kherson? The Ukrainians classify all attacks on civilians, on critical infrastructure, as war crimes. And then, as always, the police come out and examine the scene. They conduct a sort of crime scene investigation, just like we would at home, and they try to investigate and clarify these war crimes. We also spoke with a police officer who, unfortunately, did not want to give us quotes that I could record because he was concerned about being targeted by the Russians. But he did explain to us how they work, how they secure the crime scenes and collect evidence. He told me that just in Kherson and the surrounding area, they have now documented over 30,000 cases of war crimes. I also visited a forensic center, a morgue in Kherson, in a hospital located near the river. Getting there was quite dangerous. It is more or less a red zone, with very few people around. This hospital is also constantly being attacked by Russian drones, so you have to move very quickly. Our driver was not allowed to stay near the hospital because the risk was extremely high that the car could be damaged or the driver could be injured or killed, so he drove away. We entered this hospital, an old Soviet-era building, and visited the makeshift morgue. It was quite disturbing because the bodies were laid out very closely together. Many of the people we saw there had died of natural causes. We also saw an older man whose body was covered in shrapnel wounds. There, I met Natalia Filenko. She is the head of the forensic center and documents these war crimes on a daily basis. She and her team perform autopsies on those who have become victims of Russian war crimes. I spoke with her about her work and also about what these 4 years of war have done to the people.
4 years of war have exhausted the people, but we still believe that this will be Ukraine, and that's what we are working for. We love our country. We love our home. And let's put it this way. We haven't waited for anyone, and we haven't asked anyone to come and free us. We support our country, and we will defend it. We will do everything that depends on us, and on our, let's call it, shadow team.
Natalia's work is, of course, extremely demanding. She told me that now only about a third of her original team is still on site. The others have left because they are deeply afraid that something might happen to them in Kherson. Yet there are still 60,000 people living in the city, which I find incredible because originally Kherson had 300,000 residents and still 60,000 remain. As we walked around Kherson, we repeatedly saw cars moving through the streets, people doing their shopping, elderly men and women running small market stalls, selling vegetables and fruit. It's, in a way, a somewhat surreal situation in Kherson, And yes, Natalia's team, the third of her team that stayed, is there to document what is happening on the ground and to make sure these war crimes are not forgotten. Natalia's work is a mixture of horror and hope. She documents the unspeakable crimes of war, and she does it not just for today, but for the justice of tomorrow. And still, every single day, she and her team are required to summon a strength that goes beyond the human, often like a race against time. Mitya, you know him from other episodes, is now a friend of mine. He used to work for us as a fixer. He's a Ukrainian journalist. He was briefly a soldier, has now become seriously ill, and is no longer in active service. But he fought on the front lines to defend his country. Now he lives again in Odessa, and his words capture the personal toll of 4 years of war in a striking way.
Right now it is strange how normal life in Odessa can seem, especially to someone watching from afar. Shops are full of food, restaurants may be full of customers, even though they all need to have their own power generators to stay open. Your favorite cafes serve your favorite coffee, which it feels so good to take on a walk home through the park. And yet, at home for most of the day, and sometimes for many days in a row, there may be no electricity, no heating, no water. And in the park on the Alley of Fallen Heroes, you are walking through with your cappuccino. You suddenly see a picture of a smiling soldier from your unit named Pasha, who used to cook incredible borscht between rotations to the front line and was always worried for you to have a sip before it gets cold. And also I remember he would always speak so tenderly on the phone with his civilian wife, whom he had finally officially married while on a leave just a week before he was killed. And in that moment, you can barely hold back your tears.
Mitya talks about a reality in which the normal and the abnormal merge. A walk in the park leads through the Avenue of Fallen Heroes. A photo of a friend, Pasha, brings the tragedy very close. And in this war, there are obviously no clear boundaries anymore between yesterday and today. People are simply living. I notice this again and again from one day to the next. You never really know what will happen the next day. They try somehow to organize their lives. This is especially true in the cities, where there are constant power outages, heating fails, and so on. And the point really is just to somehow manage life. And they do it. Mitya reminds us that these stories don't just touch Ukraine. They could very well be ours too. We also visited a center in Odessa where the Navy runs a recruitment office. As you know, this is another story. After 4 years of war, it's becoming increasingly difficult to replenish the Ukrainian armed forces. The ranks have thinned. Tens of thousands of lives have already been lost. The cemeteries are now filled with the fallen. Everywhere in the cities, if you pass by the cemeteries, you see these huge grave fields with Ukrainian flags or the flags of the units in which the soldiers served. And these grave fields have simply grown enormous. And each of these graves stands for the fate of a fallen soldier. For someone like me, who has been traveling through Ukraine for 4 years now, it's always bitter to see just how many young people this war has already claimed. And that's why the armed forces find it relatively difficult to refill these thinned ranks. The Navy recruitment center we visited is trying to do just that. They are also trying to stop the outflow of young men abroad by offering attractive options, telling them they can choose where to serve and that they don't necessarily have to go straight to the front line. By the way, the Navy here doesn't just mean the conventional sailors you might imagine. Ukraine doesn't really have a significant fleet. What they mainly have is the Marine Infantry Corps, the Marines you might know from American films. They serve under the Navy. And for them, the recruitment office is seeking new candidates, offering opportunities to work as IT specialists, drone operators, or in other roles, so that people don't have to fear being sent directly to the front if they sign a contract. Among others, I spoke with Oleksandr Stepanovich, who explained to me how an army organizes itself in times of such crises. I am responsible for recruiting for the Navy, searching and selecting candidates for contract-based military service in the units of the naval forces, and addressing the problems we are currently facing. First and foremost, it is the power outages. I think it's difficult to work under constant bombardment and without electricity, but we do everything to ensure that our work continues. We produce content, video content, carry out promotional campaigns to keep people motivated and willing to serve in the units of the naval forces themselves.
I am responsible for recruitment within the naval forces. I search for and select candidates for contract-based military service in the units of the naval forces. As for the challenges we are currently facing, first and foremost, it's the power outages. I think it's extremely difficult to work under constant bombardment and without electricity. But we do everything to ensure that our work continues. We produce content, video material, and carry out promotional campaigns so that people stay motivated and want to serve in the units of the naval forces themselves.
So Captain Oleksandr told me that his program has been relatively successful. They have already recruited hundreds of people through this program. They also mentioned that at least one person returned from Germany, a young man who had gone to Germany to avoid service and was now reached through this program via the program's website, and he believes that this program is successful. I would put a question mark there, though. I know that the recruitment problems are immense, that the state recruiters, the so-called TZK, sometimes operate very strictly, picking people up off the streets and putting them directly into training centers. That naturally causes tensions in the country because people by now understand what it means to go to the front. The dropout rates are extremely high. There are frontline sections where maybe only 30% of people come out unscathed if they were right at the front. And of course, that is massively intimidating, which is completely understandable. Now let's move on to another man, Andriy Melnyk, whom you all know. Andriy Melnyk was for a long time the face of Ukraine in Germany. When the war, or rather the invasion, broke out, he was Ukraine's ambassador to Germany and was known for speaking very bluntly, often very undiplomatically. He repeatedly criticized the German government harshly because he thought they were too slow to act. That made him a very controversial figure in the German public eye. Andriy Melnyk is now Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations in New York, and he still believes that Europe is not showing the necessary determination and doing what Ukraine actually needs to avoid being forced into any dictated peace or submission to Russia.
Das ist das, was mich am meisten also betrübt, dass man einfach mal ja diese traurigen Jahrestage quasi ja begeht.
What troubles me the most is that the sad anniversaries of the war now almost sound normal. 4 years, thank you. Soon maybe 5 or even longer. And this mindset, it makes me angry that people have, in a way, come to terms with the war.
Die macht mich wirklich also wütend, dass man diesen Krieg so, ich will nicht sagen auf die leichte Schulter nehmen, das nicht, aber dass man sich gewisse Weise damit arrangiert.
Yes, even 4 years after the war began, he is a very, very emotional man, which I can understand. His family is in Ukraine, in Lviv and Kiev, among other places. His sister is there, his nieces are there, his parents are there. And of course, he sees how harsh the situation is for these people. So I think you can understand this emotionality. Melnyk also doesn't see much promise in the current peace negotiations. You've probably heard there were talks in Geneva, in Abu Dhabi, trilateral with Americans, Russians and Ukrainians. But Melnyk doesn't believe the Russians are taking it seriously.
Die Russen benutzen das nur, um eben quasi im Spiel zu bleiben, um die Amerikaner nicht zu verärgern. Immer wieder wird es auch quasi kleine Durchbrüche geben, wie Gefangenenaustausche, wie vor 2 Wochen. Das war wichtig für die Menschen.
The Russians are only using this to stay in the game, to avoid upsetting the Americans. Every now and then, there will be small breakthroughs, like prisoner exchanges, like the one 2 weeks ago. That was important for the people. 157 soldiers were able to return, some of them having been in captivity since 1922. But I don't believe we will see a breakthrough in the sense that this will become politically viable. As far as we're concerned, Ukraine obviously wants to show that we want this peace, that we're not playing games like the others. But what you would expect, and this isn't just my opinion, is for Europeans, as actors at the table, to help strengthen Ukraine's position, which also means strengthening Europe's position. But for that, you need more than just comforting words and pats on the shoulder and all the theatrical gestures we see now. Instead of strengthening the position and at least developing a strategy like, okay, now we're doing this and that to show that Ukraine actually has more cards in its hand than some people think. And that's basically what I wish for.
Anstatt die Position zu stärken und zumindest auch eine Strategie zu entwickeln, okay, und jetzt wird das und das getan, um eben zu zeigen, dass die Ukraine doch mehr Karten in der Hand hat, als manche denken. Und das ist quasi etwas, was ich mir wünsche.
Melnyk somehow also symbolizes the disappointment of many Ukrainians with Europe's hesitant actions on the one hand, and on the other hand, this really has to be said, the anger at the Americans, especially Trump, whose completely erratic, unpredictable approach somehow failed to put the pressure on the Russians that would have been needed for them to negotiate more seriously. And so there's a certain disappointment with Europe, but when it comes to the Americans, people in Ukraine are now very angry. By the way, this isn't just about Ukraine. This is something I've seen in many countries I've traveled to, in Syria, for example, or even in Greenland, where we also made an episode. These are all places where you're really stunned by American foreign policy. And as I said, this is especially true in Ukraine, where people feel massively abandoned by the Americans. On the other hand, Ukrainians also recognize when it comes to Europe that Germany, but also other European countries, over the past years and continuing now, have helped massively, providing weapons, economic aid, humanitarian assistance, and politically expressing solidarity. So this hasn't been forgotten. Ukrainians are extremely grateful, everyone you speak to here, and Melnyk hopes that Europe now also takes a stronger political stance, setting clearer points, not just sitting at the kids' table while Americans, Russians, and Ukrainians negotiate, but stepping up with the necessary determination to make a point and say, this war is a war in Europe, and therefore we have to have a voice. And he says Europe must do more to prevent this war from simply becoming a new normal.
Sowohl die Gegner unserer Mitgliedschaft werden das Ganze quasi sich auf die Fahnen schreiben, und das sehen wir schon heute und nicht nur von Seiten der AfD. Und nicht nur in Deutschland, das wird geschehen, und das damit müssen wir auch klarkommen. Aber ich hoffe immerhin, dass das zumindest auch ein gutes Signal an unsere Freunde in Europa.
Both opponents of our membership will claim this as their victory, and we can already see that happening today. Not just from the AfD, but not only in Germany either. We'll have to deal with that, but I at least hope that this will also send a positive signal to our friends in Europe. That they see, yes, the war is something that consumes all resources, and it's hard to think of anything else besides defense. But at the same time, they see it happening right in the middle of this mess. It's not just about arresting someone now. It's about making sure the process is transparent and that court decisions are publicly visible. That, of course, takes time, and you can't expect it to happen in just a few weeks or months. So from my perspective, this is basically a test for the Ukrainian judiciary and the authorities we've built. We need a country like this as a member of the family more than anything else.
Und nicht nur also die Festnahmen selbst und das dauert natürlich, das kann man auch nicht innerhalb von wenigen Wochen oder Monaten erwarten wahrscheinlich, und das heißt, also das ist jetzt quasi der Test aus meiner Sicht für die ukrainische auch Gerichtsbarkeit und für die Behörden, die wir aufgebaut haben. Wir brauchen so ein Land als Mitglied der Familie eher als sonst was.
Yes, so this is also a point that's widely discussed. Should Ukraine become a member of the European Union? Ukrainian President Zelensky is pushing for EU accession to be ratified as early as next year, so that Ukraine would already be participating in the European Union. I consider that very ambitious and completely unrealistic, far too fast. But of course it also shows something, and you still see it here in Ukraine, so many people looking toward Europe. This longing for Europe is stronger than ever, and I just hope that Europe values it, that it recognizes what the Ukrainian people have been doing for 4 years against Russian aggression, and what they are also doing domestically to become ready for Europe. Melnik also brought up the topic of corruption. As you know, just a few weeks ago, a huge corruption scandal in Ukraine's energy sector was uncovered, and he referred to that. Now, of course, one could say, on the one hand, this shows how corrupt Ukraine still is. On the other hand, it also shows that they are willing and able to investigate such corruption scandals. And in that sense, I think it's something that deserves recognition. The war in Ukraine is now entering its fifth year. Entire cities lie in rubble. Cities like Avdiivka, Bakhmut, Chasiv Yar, Posad Pokrovske, Mirnohrad, and others simply no longer exist. They are empty, and millions of people are on the run. And the question is, how will it continue? These peace negotiations are somehow not yielding results. Trump promised to end the war within 24 hours before taking office. Well, of course, he didn't keep that promise, just like he never fulfills what he announces and promises. And this conflict in Ukraine now feels like a race against time. You don't know which side will break first. You can feel that the Ukrainians are more tired than ever, sad, exhausted. They see that the situation in their cities is getting worse. Everyone is hoping that spring will come as quickly as possible, that temperatures will rise, so that people don't have to live in such bitter and harsh conditions as they do now. At the same time, there has also been a kind of habituation to the war. As I mentioned earlier, at the time of this recording, I am in Slovyansk, and you constantly hear the rumble of artillery, explosions, and somehow people just walk along the streets and barely react when something goes off. People have somehow grown used to this war, and I think that's something that shouldn't happen to us in Germany, that we get used to the fact that there is war, that we somehow leave this war completely out of our discussions, instead of at least keeping the people in Ukraine in our thoughts, and then also doing everything possible to end this war. And here, European politics is of course called upon. Europe stands at a crossroads. Will we continue to watch as Ukraine is exhausted in its fight, or finally intervene before the last sparks of hope in Odessa, Kherson, and other cities die out? Every drone, every missile, and every night without electricity reminds us that it's not just Ukraine that suffers. Our shared values are under attack. The resistance of Ukraine is almost unshakable, yet these people cannot win the war alone. Europe must stop hesitating. If Ukraine's freedom falls, a piece of all of us falls with it. That was today's episode of our podcast, In Crisis Mode. This podcast was produced by Alexander Baumeister. He is also a journalist and works for the radio station of the Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoyed this podcast, like and follow us. That definitely helps make our work more visible. Also, feel free to write to us if you have a suggestion for one of our episodes. chrisandmodus@funkemedien.de. Take care of yourselves. See you soon. Ciao, ciao.
Podcast von Funke.